This is a Reconstructionist radio production. Narration by Jordan Wilson. Please visit GaryNorth.com/freebooks to download this book in PDF format. Conspiracy in Philadelphia, Origins of the United States Constitution by Dr. Gary North. Publisher, Dominion Educational Ministries, Harrisonburg, Virginia. This book is dedicated to the members, living and dead, of Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America, who for over two centuries have smelled a rat in Philadelphia. Appendix B, Shays' Rebellion. Legend and Reality. The 1786-87 rebellion in Massachusetts, known as Shays' Rebellion, is generally believed to be the event that moved George Washington off the sidelines regarding Madison's proposed convention in Philadelphia. He had resisted Madison's repeated requests that he attend the convention. Washington was told by two trusted informants in Massachusetts that this was a widespread revolt of the lower classes. These rebels were undermining public order in their quest to overturn property rights. Washington believed these reports. He decided that it was time for a change in the fundamental laws of the United States. What I did not know in 1989, and no historian knew, was that the Shays Rebellion was an armed resistance movement of about 4,000 property-owning men in western Massachusetts. Contrary to reports from the anti-Shays faction in 1787, and contrary to most textbook accounts ever since, it was not a revolt of impoverished, indebted rural radicals. It included men of all economic classes. Many of them were veterans of the American Revolution, including Daniel Shays, who served from the Battle of Bunker Breeds Hill onward, and was a distinguished officer who worked his way up from the ranks to captain. Lafayette awarded him a sword for his valor. These men revolted against a group of speculators who had recently gained control over the governor's office. For over two centuries, Americans did not know the truth. Then, in one of those fluke events that every historian dreams about, Professor Leonard Richards of the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, stumbled onto a fact that no previous historian had bothered to investigate. After the defeat of the rebels, the state required each of them to sign a loyalty oath. Unlike previous political rebellions, there were archival records of those who had participated. These records were right under Professor Richards' nose, yet it took several months for him to learn that they were actually in his own university's library on microfilm. He then made a detailed investigation of the participants, the towns they lived in, their family connections, their debt position in 1786, and their political offices, if any. What he learned enabled him to rewrite the story of Shays' Rebellion. It was not a revolt of indebted farmers. It was a tax revolt. Taxes and special interests. During the Revolution, the Continental Congress had issued irredeemable paper currency to pay for the war. The infamous Continentals, as in, not worth a continental. These notes quickly fell to zero values. States imposed IOUs to pay militia members. Notes issued in April 1778 in Massachusetts quickly fell to 25% of their face value. By 1781, they were at 2% of face value. Other states followed suit. Virginia's notes fell to 1/1000th of a face value. Soldiers in the field sold these notes in order to keep their families solvent. The political question after independence was attained in 1783 resolved around the redemption price. At what percent of face value would states repay noteholders? Unlike all other states, Massachusetts legislature passed a law to redeem the notes at face value. The legislature was dominated by Boston's mercantile interests. While it is not possible to trace the ownership of all the debt after the war, what little can be traced indicates that 80% of the speculators lived in or near Boston, and almost 40% of the notes were held by 35 men. Most had bought these notes at tremendous discounts. Then, to add insult to injury, interest on these notes was retroactively made payable in silver. To pay off these speculators, taxes were raised. The main ones were the poll tax and the property tax beginning in 1785. Professor Richards describes the nature of this tax burden, quote, "Every farmer knew that he was going to have to pay for every son 16 years or older, every horse he owned, every cow, every barn, every acre in tillage. Everyone also knew that the tax bite was going to be regressive. Only about 10% of the taxes were to come from import duties and excises, which fell mainly on people who were most able to pay. The other 90% was direct taxes on property, with land bearing a disproportionate share and polls. The latter was especially regressive, since it mattered not a whit if a male 16 years of age or older had any property or not. Rich or poor, he was going to have to pay the same amount, and altogether polls were going to pay at least one-third of all taxes. But, end quote. But would these taxes actually be collected? After the Revolution, the most popular politician in Massachusetts was John Hancock, the ex-smuggler merchant whose signature is so large on the Declaration of Independence. He was among the richest men in the state. He was lenient to all poor debtors who owed him money personally. He let them pay him in depreciated paper money. The rich had to pay in silver. He was elected governor in 1780 and served for 5 years. He was also elected in 1787 and served until his death in 1793. He did not serve in 1785 through 87, the crucial period. He declined to run in 1785 because of gout. Gout normally affects the big toe. It can accurately be said that the great turning point in post-revolutionary America was John Hancock's big toe. Hancock had understood that the soldiers had been forced to sell their promissory notes for a small fraction of their face value. He was accused by opponents of refusing to collect taxes. When he left office, he was replaced by James Bowdoin, a holder of at least £3,290 in depreciated notes. He did not receive enough votes to command a majority, so the legislature had to choose. The Senate insisted on him, and the House capitulated. Under his leadership, the political faction whose members had bought up these notes gained power. The government passed new taxes and insisted on collecting taxes that were in arrears. That tax burden was now higher by several times what they had ever been under Great Britain. Western counties had petitioned the government for relief for several years, but their petitions had been ignored. In July 1786, a revolt began. It soon became an armed political revolt by towns, not by individuals. The rebels met as a convention to draw up a list of 21 grievances. This was not a mob. Daniel Shays became the head of this revolt after it had begun. Until Richard's book appeared, the standard account of Shays' rebellion emphasized the theme of farmers in the state's western counties as being heavily in debt to merchants in Boston. This account never had much evidence to support it. Boston merchants traded little with western towns, which were close to self-supporting. Also, western towns in Connecticut did not revolt. If the decisive political issue was debt, why not? There is no evidence of any debt-revolt relationship in the western counties, two-thirds of which had not revolted. The revolt's leaders were often from the higher classes. Most of the insurgents were not heavily in debt. Kinship ties, town by town, accounted for recruiting far more than debt did. The winter of 1787. The state of Massachusetts petitioned Congress to send in federal troops, but the U.S. Army at the time had approximately 700 men. Congress responded by promising to add another 1,340 men, but Massachusetts was supposed to raise 660 of these. Congress then made up a phony war story to justify sending troops to quell a tax revolt. There was a pending Indian war, Congress said. Few believe this ruse. The U.S. Army raised a total of 100 recruits. Meanwhile, militia members in Massachusetts were joining the rebels. Boston's militia responded to the legislature's call. Western counties ignored it. Especially revealing were Revolutionary War veterans. Of 634 veterans in the militia in Northampton, only 23 volunteered for duty. The two senior officers from Northampton who responded had between them a total of 14 days of service in the war. All of the rebel captains had at least 3 years' experience. Baron von Steuben, who had served under Washington, identified the problem in an article that he signed Belisarius. Massachusetts had 92,000 militiamen on its rolls. Why did the state need military support from Congress? He provided the correct answer. Massachusetts government was not representative of the opinions of the people. The rebellion was defeated in battles and skirmishes in the winter and early spring of 1787. The commander of the state's militia was General Benjamin Lincoln, who had served under Washington during the American Revolution. Lincoln's force of 4,400 men had not been authorized by the legislature, so 153 private citizens, mostly Bostonians, provided the funds to pay the troops. None of the contributors served in Lincoln's army. One impoverished Harvard graduate did serve, Royal Tyler, and soon wrote a play about the rebellion. It became the first American play, and it made his reputation. Shays and other leaders escaped across the northern border into New Hampshire, and from there went west into Vermont. Vermont's governor refused to extradite any of them, despite protests from the Massachusetts government. Shays and several other rebel leaders were staying at a farm next door to the governor, motivating George Washington. Without the participation of George Washington at the Constitutional Convention, there would not have been a Constitution. The Nationalists, who were preparing to overturn the country's legal order, were convinced of this. So are most historians of the Constitutional Convention. Washington had resisted offers from Madison and others to attend the convention. He wanted to stay out of public life. Shays' Rebellion provided the motivational hook for the Nationalists to persuade him to reverse his position and attend. Two men were critical in motivating Washington. One was General Lincoln, who wrote to him repeatedly as the rebellion accelerated. He lamented the rebellion and painted it in terms of a social revolution by the poorer classes who had tried to imitate their betters by going into debt and adopting a luxuriant mode of living, and who were now having to pay off their debts, which were owed to the industrious, who were now in a position to reap the fruits of their industry. The other was Henry Knox, who had also served as a general under Washington and who was a former Bostonian. Knox's letter of October 23, 1786, was as persuasive to Washington as it was misleading. This letter undermined Washington's firm resolve to remain a private citizen. Although he did not consent to attend the convention until the following spring, Knox wrote that he had been east of Boston on business and had hurried back because of the commotions. He immediately launched into a critique of the present political structure under the Articles of Confederation. Quote, "Our political machine, constituted of 13 independent sovereignties, have been constantly operating against each other and against the federal head ever since the peace. The powers of Congress are utterly inadequate to preserve the balance between the respective states and oblige them to do those things which are essential for their own welfare and for the general good. The human mind in the local legislature seems to be exerted to prevent the federal constitution from having any beneficial effects. The machine works inversely to the public good in all its parts. Not only is state against state and all against the federal head, but the states within themselves possess the name only without having the essential concomitant of government, the power of preserving the peace, the protection of the liberty, and the property of the citizens." End quote. So far, none of this has anything to do with Shays' Rebellion. It is clear that Knox was a nationalist. He was offering a general critique of the Confederation. He then offered what seems to be substantiating specific evidence, but his account was neither accurate nor relevant. The state of Massachusetts was in a position to suppress the rebellion, assuming that the militia would respond to the call. The fact was, the handful of speculators close to the governor could not persuade the legislature to fund the counterattack, nor could local officers persuade militia members to respond to the call to arms. This was a grassroots rebellion, as surely as the American War for Independence had been, and with far better cause. None of this impressed Knox, who continued in the same paragraph, quote, "On the very first impression of faction and licentiousness, the fine theoretic government of Massachusetts has given way, and its laws arrested and trampled underfoot. Men at a distance who have admired our systems of government, unfounded in nature, are apt to accuse the rulers and say that the taxes have been assessed too high and collected too rigidly. This is a deception equal to any that has hitherto been entertained. It is indeed a fact that high taxes are the ostensible cause of the commotions, but that they are the real cause is far more remote from truth as light from darkness. The people who are the insurgents have never paid any but very little taxes. But they see the weakness of government. They feel at once their own poverty compared with the opulent and their own force, and they are determined to make use of the latter in order to remedy the former." End quote. That the Western farmers had not paid high taxes prior to 1786 was true. Hancock had refused to collect them. But Bowdoin, as a holder of Massachusetts notes, was ready to enforce the law. He had the support of his cronies, who had held the state's notes, but not of the Massachusetts legislature, which never did vote to fund Lincoln's troops. Knox did not convey any of this information to Washington. Instead, he turned the revolt into a revolt against property. It was in fact a revolt against the confiscation of property by a tiny group of speculators in government debt, but Knox painted the movement as an organized interstate conspiracy of communists against property. Quote, "Their creed is that the property of the United States has been protected from the confiscations of Britain by the joint exertions of all, and therefore ought to be the common property of all, and he that attempts opposition to this creed is an enemy to equity and justice and ought to be swept from the face of the earth. In a word, they are determined to annihilate all debts public and private, and have agrarian laws which are easily affected by the means of unfunded paper money, which shall be a tender in all cases whatever. The number of these people may amount in Massachusetts to about one-fifth of part of several populous counties, and to them may be collected people of similar sentiments, from the states of Rhode Island, Connecticut, and New Hampshire, so as to constitute a body of 12,000 or 15,000 desperate and unprincipled men. They are chiefly of the young and active part of the community, more easily collected than perhaps kept together afterwards. But they will probably commit overt acts of treason, which will compel them to embody for their own safety. Once embodied, they will be constrained to submit to discipline for the same reason. End quote. None of this was true. The men were led by adults, and these adults were leaders in their respective towns. There was no connection to Rhode Island, which had debased its currency, or any other colony. They were fighting a system of oppressive taxation that was being imposed in the name of paying off investors who had bought the depreciated notes of the Revolutionary War era from the soldiers who made that political rebellion successful. Rebels were fighting against the transformation, mostly at their expense, of the unfunded paper money of the war era into post-war currency, with interest payable in silver. They had been stiffed by the politicians during the war, who paid them with unfunded promises to pay. Now they were being stiffed by the politicians again, speculators who had taken advantage of them when they were on the battlefield. But Knox ignored all of this. He had a political agenda, and Washington's presence at the convention was the linchpin, the sine qua non of the nationalist political agenda. Knox proceeded with the grand deception of the grand old man. Quote, "Having proceeded to this length for which they are now ripe, we shall have a formidable rebellion against reason, the principles of all government, and the very name of liberty. This dreadful situation has alarmed every man of principle and property in New England. They start as from a dream, and ask what can have been the cause of our delusion? What is to afford a security against the violence of lawless men? Our government must be braced, changed, or altered to secure our lives and property. We imagined that the mildness of our government and the virtue of the people were so correspondent that we were not as other nations requiring brutal force to support the laws." End quote. Hence, it was time to brace, change, or alter the national government so as to supply the required brutal force. Quote, "But we find that we are men, actual men, possessing all the turbulent passions belonging to that animal, and that we must have a government proper and adequate for him." End quote. Knox was writing a direct response sales letter, which turned out to be the second most influential sales letter in American history, second only to Washington's letter to Congress on September 17, 1787. Every direct response letter needs a powerful close, what is called the Act Now offer. Knox called on Washington to join with the besieged men of property in Massachusetts, speculators in government bonds, to turn back these rural communists of the lower sort. The nationalists were ready to defend the true interests of society. "What about you, George? Will you wimp out at this crucial juncture?" Knox was a master of the close. Quote, "The people of Massachusetts, for instance, are far more advanced in this doctrine, and the men of reflection and principle are determined to endeavor to establish a government which shall have the power to protect them in their lawful pursuits, and which will be efficient in all cases of internal commotions or foreign invasions. They mean that liberty be the basis, a liberty resulting from the equal and firm administration of laws. They wish for a general government of unity, as they see the local legislatures must naturally and necessarily tend to retard and frustrate all government involved general government. We have arrived at that point of time in which we are forced to see our national humiliation, and that a progression in this line cannot be productive of happiness, either public or private. Something is wanting, and something must be done, or we shall be involved in all the horror of faction and civil war without a prospect of its termination. Every tried friend to the liberties of his country is bound to reflect and to step forward to prevent the dreadful consequences which will result from a government of events. Unless this is done, we shall be liable to be ruled by an arbitrary and capricious armed tyranny, whose word and will must be law." End quote. He followed up with a similar letter on December 17th. "A government without any existing means of coercion are at a loss to combat or avert a danger now and so pressing." End quote. End quote. "It is probable that all about one-fifth part of the people of New England, whose habits and manners are similar, are liable to be infected by the principles of the insurgents, and of consequence to act in the same manner." End quote. His letter elicited this response from Washington on December 26th. Quote, "I feel, my dear General Knox, infinitely more than I can express to you, for the disorders which have arisen in these states. Notwithstanding the boasted virtue of America, we are far gone in everything ignoble and bad. In this, as in most other matters, we are too slow. When this spirit first dawned, probably it might easily have been checked, but it is scarcely within reach of human ken at this moment to say when, where, or how it will end. There are combustibles in every state which a spark may set fire to." End quote. He then inquired regarding Madison's proposed convention in Philadelphia. He relied on Knox as an accurate source of intelligence regarding public opinion. Quote, "By a late act, it seems very desirous of a general convention to revise and amend the federal constitution. What are the prevailing sentiments of the one now proposed to be held at Philadelphia in May next, and how will it be attended? You are the fountain of intelligence, and where the wisdom of the nation is to be presumed has concentred. Consequently, better able, as I've had abundant experience of your intelligence, confidence, and candor, to solve these questions." End quote. Knox had the answer ready to go. He sent it 5 days before Washington asked his opinion. The letters probably crossed en route to each other. Quote, the commotions of Massachusetts have wrought prodigious changes in the minds of men in that state respecting the powers of government. Everybody says they must be strengthened, and that unless this shall be effected, there is no security for liberty or property." End quote. Next, having been asked, Scott Knox sent a long letter to Washington on January 14th that presented the case for the Constitution, for the convention. He said that some people regard the proposed convention as, quote, "an irregular assembly, unauthorized by the Confederation, which points out the mode by which any alteration should be made," end quote. Others think that the convention should be attended by people appointed by state conventions. Madison used this system of state conventions to legitimize the convention after the fact, state conventions to vote the new Constitution up or down. Quote, "There are others who are of the opinion that Congress ought to take up the defects of the present system, point them out to the respective legislatures, and recommend certain alterations," end quote. He then told Washington that if he would attend, Eastern states would send delegates. He said that he thought the people would accept the changes if they were recommended by, quote, a respectable set of men as could be sent to the convention, end quote. Furthermore, quote, "Were strong events to arise between this and the time of the meeting, enforcing the necessity of a vigorous government, it would be a preparation which might be embraced by the convention to propose at once an efficient system," end quote. How convenient that as he was writing this letter, just such a strong event was taking place in Massachusetts. In a series of letters to Washington, the Nationalists put pressure on him to attend. In his replies, he made it clear that he was on the side of law and order, and that he was becoming pessimistic regarding the future of the country. He resisted making a commitment to attend, but eventually he consented. He was already a Nationalist, as his letters reveal from 1783 on. He had written to John Jay the previous spring that it is necessary to revise and amend the Articles of Confederation. I entertain no doubt, but what may be the consequences of such an attempt is doubtful. Yet something must be done, or the fabric must fall. It certainly is tottering. The gun was already loaded. The misinformation passed on to him about Shays' rebellion was the trigger. Eventually, Washington pulled it. He attended the convention and even agreed to keep Madison's secret notes of the debates, which were not made public until every participant had died. Conclusion. Shays' rebellion was used effectively by the Nationalists to scare voters into accepting both the legitimacy of the convention and the legality of the Constitution. Within months, Shays' rebellion gave the Nationalists the edge they needed. It provided the spark on which to advance the Nationalist cause and play on the fears of others. In the post-convention debates over ratification, anti-Federalists were labeled Shaysites. With respect to Massachusetts, the accusation was inaccurate. Two-thirds of the towns opposed ratification, yet only one-third had joined the rebellion. Had John Hancock not been struck by gout in 1785, he would have run for governor. He would have won, just as he did in 1787, the year that the rebellion was put down. Because Governor Bowdoin's faction gained control of law enforcement in 1785 and 87, the rebellion had taken place. the rebellion in Massachusetts was what forced Washington's hand. He decided to support Madison's plan for the meeting in Philadelphia of leading politicians, who would then create a new form of civil government, therefore replacing the Articles of Confederation. He decided to attend the convention, contrary to his previous statements. His presence at the convention and his promotional letter to Congress that had accompanied the proposed Constitution were crucial to the success of the Nationalist plans to overturn the existing national government. Thus, the fate of the proposed United States Constitution had turned on John Hancock's big toe. The sequence of events reminds me of a truth suggested by the sociologist historian Robert Nisbet in 1968. He was writing of academic techniques of scientific forecasting. Quote, "What the future predictors, the change analysts, and trend trenders say, in effect, is that with the aid of institute resources, computers, linear programming, etc., they will deal with the kinds of change that are not the consequence of the random event, the genius, the maniac, and the prophet, to which I can only say, there really aren't any, not worth looking at anyhow." End quote. Quote by Philip Schaff, 1888. But some Protestant confessions of faith framed in the Reformation period, when church and state were closely interwoven, ascribed to the civil magistrate ecclesiastical powers and duties which are Erastian or Caesaro-papal in principle and entirely inconsistent with the freedom and self-government of the church. Hence, changes in the political articles of these confessions became necessary. The Presbyterian Church took the lead in this progress even long before the American Revolution. After the Revolutionary War, The United Synod of Philadelphia and New York met at Philadelphia, May 28, 1787, at the same time and in the same place as the convention which framed the Federal Constitution, and proposed important alterations in the Westminster Confession, chapters 20, closing paragraph, 23, and 21. 20, 23, and 31. 1, 2, so as to eliminate the principle of state churchism and religious prosecution, and to proclaim religious liberty and legal equality of all Christian denominations. These alterations were formally adopted by the Joint Synod at Philadelphia, May 28, 1788, and have been faithfully adhered to by the large body of the Presbyterian Church in America. It is worthy of note that the scripture passages quoted by the Old Confession in favor of state churchism and the ecclesiastical power of the civil magistrate are all taken from the Old Testament. End quote. Appendix C. Philadelphia's Other Constitutional Convention. On Friday, May 25, 1787, the first meeting of the Constitutional Convention began in Philadelphia. George Washington was elected president of the convention. A secretary was elected, Major Jackson. The meeting was then adjourned. The convention began its first full session on Monday, May 28. Across town, another meeting was ending on that fateful Monday. The United Presbyterian Synods of New York and Philadelphia had met together. What they did at that final session, and at the meeting exactly 1 year later, was to change the course of Protestantism in America. It also paralleled to a remarkable degree the political events being engineered by James Madison. The issues were also similar. The relation of church and state and the issue of centralized authority. Like Madison and his associates, between 1785 and 1787, a quiet group of churchmen in the Presbyterian Church had been preparing for a major reorganization. Even today, it is not entirely clear from the historical records just who was behind this push. There was no sense of imminent ecclesiastical crisis, but there was a sense of failure in the face of continuing problems that never seemed to get resolved. The standard argument of the Christian Constitution defenders is that the Constitution is implicitly Christian because it was accepted by Christian voters at the time. What they do not understand is the extent to which Whig notions of sovereignty had affected the Christians of that era. To argue that Christians would have opposed the Constitution had it been non-Christian assumes that the terms of political discourse in Christian circles was self-consciously Christian. On the contrary, Christian discourse had become Whig Unitarian with respect to the issues of church-state relations. The English dissenters, or Commonwealthmen of the early 18th century, had moved the idea of pluralism from Oliver Cromwell's Protestant religious pluralism to some variant of Roger Williams' religiously neutral civil order. The dissenters of 1720 had abandoned Cromwell's idea of religious toleration of all Protestant sects. They had done so by extending the concept of religious toleration to the concept of the secular republic. This outlook had taken over political discourse at the Constitutional Convention in 1787. It had also taken over Presbyterian discourse at the Philadelphia Convention in 1787. The Presbyterian attendees at the Westminster Assembly, from 1643 to 1647, which produced the foundational judicial documents of Presbyterianism, would not have understood the theology undergirding the revisions of 1787. The problem of geography. War weariness had affected all the denominations, Presbyterians included. What had begun as a sacred cause of liberty had produced unforeseen negative results, as war always does. The loose morals that the war had unleashed made the church's work that much more difficult. Power shifts were already taking place within the denomination. Increased immigration from Scotland was making the church more theologically conservative, and therefore less enthusiastic about the pluralistic theological heritage of the era of the First Great Awakening. At the same time, these immigrants were heading west, where there were no well-organized presbyteries. There was also a growing reaction against deism, skepticism, and the increasingly liberal rationalism of the remnants of Jonathan Edwards' rationalistic theology, the New Side heritage. Attendance at the annual synod meetings had declined during the war and had not recovered. The expanding geography of the American nation by 1780 had overthrown the theory of a single annual synod meeting that could handle all business not capable of being handled at the presbytery level. Changes were needed. A committee was appointed in 1787 to draw up a new form of Presbyterian discipline. Then, later in the day, another overture was suggested, the creation of a synod, along the lines of the Scottish Church and the creation of three synods. The records do not indicate who made this overture. On the face of it, this overture was highly peculiar. If the institutional problem facing the denomination was geographical, why would anyone propose the creation of a synod? The answer should have been obvious: to centralize the denomination once and for all. If the regional presbyteries were becoming more distant from the center, then there would have to be a central representative body as well as central judicial body that could hold the church's governmental system together. This was exactly what Madison had concluded regarding American civil government. The committee on overture took over. A second study on church government began. As is usual for Presbyterianism, no official decision was made at that time. This was paralleled by the late March meeting at Mount Vernon, at which Maryland and Virginia commissioners proposed ways of settling trade disputes. And like the synod meeting, the records of what took place are unclear. A poorly attended synod in 1786 resolved to create 16 new presbyteries. Action on the creation of four synods was postponed. The report of the committee on discipline was discussed, but no action was taken. A new committee was set up to continue the study. A meeting in September of 1786 led to a draft of a whole new constitution to which the presbyteries generally paid little attention. These events were paralleled by Madison and Hamilton's inclusive Annapolis Convention in September, which in turn led to the call for the convention in Philadelphia. Then came the Synod of 1787. From May 16th to May 28th, the Synod met in Philadelphia to discuss the formation of a new church structure. On the last day of the Synod, May 28th, the Synod voted to create yet another committee to print 1,000 copies of the draft of the proposed form of government to be sent to the presbyteries for consideration. But the presbyteries did not have to confirm the plan in order for the 1788 Synod to make the changes official, unlike the Constitutional Convention's decision to have state ratifying conventions vote on the proposed new plan of government. The changes recommended by the committee were approved by the joint synod meeting exactly 1 year later in Philadelphia, May 28, 1788. This judicial act established a new constitution, 46 pages long, for the Presbyterian Church in America. The form of government radically centralized power in the National Synod. From that time on, it would take a two-thirds vote of the presbyteries plus the assent of the Synod, or later the General Assembly, to make further changes. The 1788 Synod did this on its own authority after consultation with the presbyteries. The presbyteries did not vote. Trinterud tries to make this sound as if it was not a monumental centralization of power. After all, he says, the Synod could not initiate any further changes, only the presbyteries could. This is hardly persuasive. Try to organize presbyteries that are scattered across a growing country. Get them to initiate and then organize fundamental change. The whole discussion of the change in church government had arisen in 1785 because of the supposed need to escape the annual meetings in Philadelphia. The new plan also entitled the Synod to issue standing rules, which a majority of the presbyteries would have to ratify. Any student of bureaucracy can see what the results would be. The Synod would normally be attended by the activists in the presbyteries. Thus, any organized resistance in over half of the presbyteries would be unlikely. To change this new system, it would take a two-thirds vote of the presbyteries, church and state. The restructured form of government included a revision of the Westminster Confession of Faith, specifically Chapter 20. closing paragraph, chapter 23 and 31. 2. These were the sections dealing with the relationship of church and state, in which the civil magistrate was charged with certain tasks, such as defending the church and calling church assemblies. The main figure on the committee was John Rogers, who had served on all of them since 1785. He became an ecclesiastical leader in the late 1760s during the colonial battle against the sending of an Anglican bishop to the colonies. He believed so greatly in the separation of church and state that he thought ministers should not vote in civil elections. The synod was adjourned. In 1788, it reconvened, and the recommended changes in the confession were approved. Church historian Philip Schaff describes these alterations, quote, "The changes consist in the omission of those sentences which imply the union of church and state, or the principle of ecclesiastical establishments, making it the duty of the civil magistrate not only to protect but also to support religion, and giving it to the magistrate power to call and ratify ecclesiastical synods and councils, and to punish heretics. Instead of this, the American revision confines the duty of the civil magistrate to the legal protection of religion in its public exercise, without distinction of Christian creeds or organizations. It thus professes the principle of religious liberty and equality of all denominations before the law. This principle has been faithfully and consistently adhered to by the large body of the Presbyterian Church in America, and has become the common law of the land." End quote. The Synod of 1788, in its last official act as a synod, appointed John Witherspoon to address the new synod before it elected a moderator, which was John Rogers. This seemed appropriate, for it was Witherspoon who almost certainly had written the preface to the proposed new form of government back in 1786. The preface stated, quote, "God alone is Lord of the conscience, and hath left it free from the doctrine and commandments of men, which are in anything contrary to his word, or beside it in matters of faith or worship. Therefore they, Presbyterians, consider the rights of private judgment, and all matters that respect religion, as universal and inalienable. They do not even wish to see any religious constitution aided by the civil power, further that may be necessary for protection and security, and at the same time be equal and common to others." End quote. Thus ended the ideal of the theocratic republic in mainstream Presbyterianism and American Protestantism in general. That this official position had been articulated by the president of the College of New Jersey was fitting. Its predecessor, the Log College, had been the leading light in the battle against what Trinitarid calls the, quote, "narrow spirit of denominationalism." Founded in 1746, its trustees had invited newly appointed Governor Johnson Belcher into the Board of Trustees in 1748. They immediately voted him president of the board. Governor Belcher saw to it that the college was granted a new charter, and he worked hard to create a new board filled, with three exceptions, with graduates of Harvard and Yale. This is understandable. He had been governor of Massachusetts from 1730 through 1741. The College of New Jersey College was moved to Newark in 1755. It was moved to Princeton. That Jonathan Belcher became the driving force of the development of the College of New Jersey is representative of what was taking place throughout the colonies. Belcher was not a Presbyterian. Nevertheless, he found it easy to cooperate with Presbyterians. His theology was expressly geared to cooperation. Jonathan Belcher was a Freemason. But this puts it too mildly. Jonathan Belcher was the original Freemason in the colonies, having been initiated in London in 1704. He was literally the pioneer. One Masonic historian refers to him as the, quote, "the senior Freemason of America." After his initiation, he experienced rapid success as a merchant. His son became the deputy grand master of the Provincial Grand Lodge of Massachusetts as its founding in 1733. In 1741, the brethren of the first lodge read a message to Mr. Belcher, who had been succeeded by a new governor the previous spring. The lodge thanked him for the many favors you have always shared when in power to Masonry in general. End quote. The spirit of non-denominationalism at the College of New Jersey was not going to be overturned by Brother Belcher. It should be no surprise to learn what President Witherspoon revealed in 1776 in his quest for non-denominational money from donors in Bermuda, namely that no discussion of church government was tolerated at the college. Ecclesiology, apparently, is subsumed under adiaphora, things indifferent to the Christian religion. Quote, "Every question about forms of church government is so entirely excluded that, if they, the students, know nothing more of religious controversy than what they learn here, they have that science wholly to begin." End quote. Thus concludes Trinitarid. James Madison did not learn about Presbyterian polity from Witherspoon. Quote, The theological doctrine of natural law and the political theory of natural rights provided the meeting place for Presbyterian and citizen rather than the Presbyterian form of church government. New England Congregationalists and Virginia Episcopalians stood with American Presbyterian laymen in this political theory. And with this this common heritage, they were able to work together, although their heritages in ecclesiastical polity still separated them widely. Brother Belcher would have been proud. Whigs Ecclesiastical. 3 weeks after Witherspoon delivered his speech on June 21, 1788, New Hampshire's convention became the ninth state convention to ratify the U.S. Constitution, which immediately went into force as the new covenant of the nation. Thus, the Whigs political and the Whigs ecclesiastical had at last overturned the covenantal foundations which had been established by their 17th century Puritan enemies, and had done so in a period of slightly less than 13 months. Governor William Livingston of New Jersey was correct when he observed in 1790 that the clergy of America were, quote, almost all universally good Whigs. He himself had been the, quote, American Whig in 1768 when he wrote or at least organized a series of New York Gazette and Pennsylvania Journal articles against sending an Anglican bishop to the colonies, a step regarded by many colonists as being the first step in parliamentary control over colonial religion. Yet it was the American Whig himself who had asked rhetorically the most important question in American history, quote, why might not Christianity have been allowed the honor of being called the national religion, end quote. The answer should be clear by now, because the Unitarians did not want it that way, and the Whigs ecclesiastical did not really think that the implicit Christianity of the nation was threatened by the idolatry of the new national covenant, i.e. the people as the new national god. A year after the 1788 Synod, in May of 1789, the Synod had John Witherspoon again chair a committee, this time to prepare an address to the newly elected President of the United States. The alternate chairman was John Rogers. The committee drafted a lengthy report in which it expressed those sentiments that have been passed down from textbooks to textbook. Echoing Washington's Masonic rhetoric, the address announced, quote, public virtue is the most certain means of public felicity, and the religion is the surest basis of virtue. We, therefore, esteem it a peculiar happiness to behold in our chief magistrate a steady, uniform, avowed friend of the Christian religion, and who on the most public and solemn occasions devoutly acknowledges the government of divine providence, end quote. The address then identified the role of the Presbyterian Church in the American political religion, quote, we shall consider ourselves as doing an acceptable service to God in our profession when we contribute to render men sober, honest, and industrious citizens and the obedient subjects of a lawful government, end quote. The Grand Master from Virginia politely responded in kind. Conclusion. I have argued elsewhere that the Church sets the pattern for what the state does. The pair of constitutional assemblies held on May 28, 1787, one civil, the other ecclesiastical, one beginning, the other ending, are the best representative examples in American history of how a change in the thinking of Christians parallels a change in the thinking of politicians. As the Presbyterians closed their meeting and the framers opened theirs, the nation was turned down a path that would have been covenantally unthinkable anywhere on earth a generation earlier, except, of course, in Rhode Island. In this case, the change in men's thinking transformed the constitutional, i.e. covenantal, foundations of both church and state in America. What had been called the Presbyterian Rebellion by its enemies in England became a Presbyterian Revolution judicially. The Presbyterians and the framers ended the Holy Commonwealth ideal in America. The Presbyterians in Philadelphia, like the lawyers in Philadelphia, removed the covenantal foundations of the American Christian experiment in Christian self-government. Without these covenantal cornerstones to support it, the American Trinitarian edifice collapsed. We live today in its ruins. Appendix D, Freemasons in the American Revolution. This is not an easy topic to sort out. Masonic historians disagree among themselves. Two books deal in detail with this question, one by Ronald Heaton and the other by Philip Roth. Ronald Heaton. The Masonic Service Association published Ronald Heaton's Masonic Membership of the Founding Fathers in 1965. This book contains detailed biographies of about 200 men of the Revolution, of whom about a third were Masons, and a third may have been. He is judicious in naming the lodges and source documents for attributing membership to anyone. He says that the 10 signers of the original Continental Articles of Association were Masons, 9 of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, 9 of the signers of the Articles of Confederation, 13 of the signers of the Constitution, 33 general officers of the Continental Army, and 8 of Washington's 29 aides or military secretaries. His list includes the following men: Thomas Adams, Benedict Arnold, Hodijah Baylis, Gunning Bedford Jr., Edward Biddle, John Blair, David Brearley, Jacob Broom, Daniel Carroll, Richard Carey, Richard Caswell, James Clinton, father of DeWitt, Jonathan Dayton, Elias Dayton, John Dickinson, William Ellery, John Fitzgerald, Benjamin Franklin, Joseph Fry, Nicholas Gilman, Mordecai Gist, John Glover, John Greeton, John Hancock, Edward Hand, Cornelius Harnett, Joseph Hughes, James Hogan, William Hooper, Charles Humphreys, David Humphreys, Rufus King, Henry Knox, Lafayette, Henry Lawrence, Benjamin Lincoln, James McHenry, William Maxwell, Hugh Mercer, Richard Montgomery, J.P.G. Muhlenberg, John Nixon, Robert Treat Payne, William Palfrey, Samuel Holden Parsons, John Patterson, William Patterson, Israel Putnam, Rufus Putnam, Edmund Randolph, Peyton Randolph, Daniel Robredo, Arthur St. Clair, Jonathan Bayard Smith, John Stark, Baron von Studen, Richard Stockton, John Sullivan, Jethro Sumner, William Thompson, James Mitchell Varnum, John Walker, George Walton, George Washington, George Whedon, William Whipple, Otho Holland Williams, William Woodford, David Wooster. To this list should be added Joseph Warren and Paul Revere of Boston, whose lodge was closely associated with the Boston Tea Party. James Otis is missing. So is Robert Livingston of New York. So is John Paul Jones. Above all, so was John Marshall. Philip Roth. Philip A. Roth self-published Masonry and the Formation of Our Government in 1727. He was the past master of Henry L. Palmer, Lodge No. 301, and was at the time manager of the Masonic Service Bureau in Washington, D.C. The book provides biographies of key figures in the American Revolution, including English figures, and also includes some brief summaries of key events, such as the inauguration of President Washington. Roth was judicious. He did not claim that anyone was a Mason unless he could document the actual lodge in which he was a member or was initiated. His list includes the following men: General Benedict Arnold, Colonel William Barton, John Blair, Edmund Burke, British, Richard Caswell, George Clinton, General James Clinton, General Johann DeKalb, General William Davy, General Mordecai Gist, Benjamin Franklin, Nathaniel Greene, Richard Gridley, Nathan Hale, Alexander Hamilton, probably, John Hancock, General Edward Hand, Nicholas Herkimer, General James Jackson, John Paul Jones, John Paul Lafayette, Henry Lighthorse Harry Lee, Richard Henry Lee, Morgan Lewis, General Benjamin Lincoln, Robert Livingston, John Marshall, General Hugh Mercer, Jacob Morton, Reverend John Paul Muhlenberg, James Otis, General Sam Parsons, William Pitt, British, General Thomas Proctor, Israel Putnam, Rufus Putnam, Edmund Randolph, Peyton Randolph, Paul Revere, Major General Philip Schuyler, Roger Sherman, probably, General John Stark, Baron von Steuben, General John Sullivan, Joseph Warren, George Washington, General Anthony Wayne, probably, General Otho Williams, and General David Wooster. This audio version of Conspiracy in Philadelphia by Dr. Gary North has been produced by Reconstructionist Radio and narrated by Jordan Wilson. Please visit garynorth.com/freebooks to download the PDF of this book.
The Reconstructionist Radio Podcast Network brings to you a complete lineup of podcasts where you will hear practical and tactical theology. Our desire is not simply that you consume our shows, but that you also live out your faith in every area of life. We can talk all day long about these things, but if we fail to put them into practice, then we fail as ambassadors of Jesus Christ, our King. Subscribe now to your favorite Reconstructionist Radio Podcast Network shows. Or you can subscribe to the Reconstructionist Radio Master Feed, where all of the content we produce, including the audiobooks and audio articles, will pop up as soon as they are available. And don't forget to visit ReconstructionistRadio.com to volunteer as a narrator or to partner with this ministry financially. May the Holy Spirit stir you into action for Christ and His kingdom.